Here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 81 and mostly cloudy. Tonight it will be cloudy with a low in the upper 60s. Then tomorrow mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 70s. Tomorrow night a few showers with a low in the upper 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
If it's in Texas, it's in Texas Monthly. Howdy, welcome to our program. I'm KC Job, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. Our first article will be from our May issue. It's one of our feature articles by Emily McCullough entitled, This Too Shall Pass. But in the meantime, Jenny Lawson is there for you. In her best-selling memoirs, her eclectic taxidermy-filled San Antonio bookstore, and her unvarnished tweets, the author makes light of her darkest times and helps her readers make light of theirs. Anyone who's read Jenny Lawson's work knows that the 47-year-old writer suffers from rheumatoid arthritis. Once, it made her fingers swell up like a ballpark hot dog. Another time, her ankle got so big, it looked as if she were wearing a single nude leg warmer stuffed with apples. Often, flare-ups leave her bedridden or send her rushing to the emergency room. She's joked that she wishes the condition had a sexier name like the Midnight Death or Impending Vampirism. It is a painful, incurable autoimmune disorder that affects everything from her shoe size, it fluctuates, to the way she experiences rain. Her symptoms worsen. It's also the reason an in-person interview during the 11th month of a deadly pandemic was completely out of the question. I went out once to see my doctor, and it was the first time someone other than my husband or daughter had touched me in a year, Lawson told me over Zoom in February. She wasn't complaining, just stating a fact. She was almost cheerful in her delivery, as if she'd long ago made peace with life in isolation. The cadence of her voice was as springy as the red floral pattern on her flowy dress. As we talked, her brown eyes lit up behind her slightly cat-eyed glasses. Occasionally, she'd pull a foot up to her desk chair, holding her ankle. For someone who writes so frequently and candidly about social anxiety, she seemed completely at ease. She'd logged in from the Northwest San Antonio home she shares with her husband, whom her readers know by his middle name, Victor, and their teenage daughter, Haley. I'd set up my laptop in Nowhere Bookshop, a store the Lawsons began operating in Alamo Heights in 2019. The space is still not technically open to the public. Since we had to remain physically apart, I would commune with the author and Twitter sensation from her shop, surrounded by her wares and eclectic decor. Think Haunted Victorian in a Western in the Narnia universe. The bookstore's ceilings are lofty. Its floors are an ornate, melon-colored saltillo tile, a relic from the building's past life as the El Paso Import Company. On the blue-gray walls, Lawson has hung drawings from Alice in Wonderland, work she purchased from a Russian cartoonist on Etsy. The store has a huge children's section, and there's just as much shelf space given to genre fiction, horror, sci-fi, mystery, graphic novels, as to highfalutin literature. Animals are everywhere. A big cat sculpture guards the front door, and a South African bontebok head is mounted at the back of the shop. Lawson dressed it in a medieval headband and scarf that she made herself and named it Antelope Bolin. Lawson's father was a taxidermist who collected critters both dead and alive. For a time, the family even had pet raccoons. It has saved my sanity, Lawson said, of running a bookstore in the middle of a plague. The business has survived through curbside pickups, online orders, and a monthly book club, which has drawn 2,700 paid subscribers across the country. And because there are never customers inside the store, it's been a haven for Lawson. She stops by on Sundays when the shop is closed and her four employees have the day off. On these visits, Lawson looks through the books, and she might send a note or two to her general manager, Elizabeth Jordan, the former CEO of Austin's Book People. Mostly, she just basks in the bookshop's ethereal glow. Store is equal parts silly and macabre, a fitting vibe for an author known for cracking jokes about the darkest and most difficult aspects of her life. Lawson is renowned in part for her zany antics, like when she impulse bought a 5-foot-tall metal chicken sculpture, which she named Beyoncé. But she is just as famous for writing openly and often about her physical and mental ailments. She chronicles her depression, avoidant personality disorder, and depersonalization disorder with frankness and humor. Sprinkled in like paprika over a mentally unbalanced deviled egg, she's written, are things like mild OCT and trichotillomania, a disorder that can cause Lawson to pull out her own hair. She jokingly refers to herself as crazy and a bit touched, her grandmother's parlance. Lawson's writing might be described as come for the jokes, stay for the inspirational tale of survival in the face of debilitating mental and physical illness, and also some more jokes. And it has earned her a massive, passionate following. She started her writing career as an unpaid blogger for the Houston Chronicle in the mid-aughts, and now her own site, The Blogess, regularly sees 100,000 visitors a week. A few years ago, when she had time to write more than 2 weekly posts, her readership typically hit 500,000 a week. Her first book of essays, Let's Pretend This Never Happened, a mostly true memoir, made its debut on the New York Times bestseller list in 2012, and her second book, Furiously Happy, a funny book about horrible things, hit the bestseller list in 2015. Her latest book, Broken, in the best possible way, was published in April. Today, she has nearly 500,000 Twitter followers. Whenever she tweets about a depressive episode and her commitment to surviving it, hundreds and sometimes thousands of supportive responses flood her mentions, which is why Jenny Lawson hasn't felt that lonely during the year of being mostly alone. I've had some really low depressions over the past year, she said. I'm really lucky that I have an amazing community of people online. She has her Twitter friends and her bookstore and her book club, the Fantastic Strangelings, which is a source of both social activity, it has a lively Facebook group, and endless entertainment. Lawson reads voraciously before settling on each month's pick. She's coping, especially by pandemic standards, but it hasn't always been that way. Lawson doesn't know where her anxiety came from, but it was always there. She had a panic attack as early as daycare. Growing up in the small West Texas town of Wall, near San Angelo, Lawson would hide in her wooden toy box in the mornings when it was time to leave, her little legs cramping, her heart pounding in her ears. She could hear her mother calling her name, and she knew she should come out. Part of her really wanted to, but she was paralyzed by the fear that everything could go wrong in the minute she left home. She could get lost. Her little sister could run into traffic. Lawson's mother eventually coaxed her out of the box and into the car, but she would often have to leave work early to pick up her daughter because she'd been crying so much at daycare that she'd made herself throw up. My mom eventually started putting notes into my pockets and my lunches and notebooks because if I saw the notes, I'd be reminded that everything was okay and that she was still alive, Lawson recalled. Lawson had a close relative with severe anxiety who would lock herself in enclosed spaces well into adulthood. Her family figured Lawson was the same way. Lawson's mom told friends and family that her older daughter was quirky and had a nervous stomach. Lawson often thinks of her relative, whom she asked not to be identified in this story. She was 30 years older than I was, and her anxiety levels were just crazy, she said. When I was growing up, I would always see her, and she would hide in a bathroom. I had an eating disorder, and she was just so terrified and unmedicated, and really, at the time, had no idea what it was that was really wrong with her, and she didn't survive it. I wish that I could have done more to help her. During Christmases with her extended family, Lawson would hide under the kitchen table. In elementary school, whenever she had to give a presentation in front of the class, she'd get so nervous that she couldn't speak. Instead, she'd laugh hysterically until she was allowed to sit back down. My fifth grade teacher thought it was hilarious and would bring me up in front of class just to watch me laugh, Lawson told me. At the time, I thought she was trying to help me get over it, but honestly, now it feels a little messed up. Making friends was terrifying. It wasn't that the other children didn't like her. It was that Lawson was afraid of them, though she didn't understand exactly why. She used to bring a book with her to the lunchroom, and if anyone acknowledged her, she'd pretend to be so absorbed in what she was reading that she couldn't hear them. By the time she started high school in 1988, Lawson still felt she had very little control over her anxiety, but she'd learned to self-soothe with the things she enjoyed, like Stephen King novels and the TV adaptation of Little House on the Prairie. She began to embrace the parts of herself that felt aberrant. She wore black lipstick and thick eyeliner, turning herself into the only goth kid at her West Texas high school. She even tried to pierce her nose with a fish hook, but chickened out and opted for a clip-on instead. Lawson had also figured out a way to comfortably connect with her peers, writing notes. Passing messages in class in the hallways was, of course, all the rage back in pre-cell phone times. Lawson excelled in the medium. Physical distance between her and her recipients eased her social anxiety. She could be funny in notes. "That would be how I would communicate with friends," she recalled, "and then I just generally wouldn't talk to them much other than that." In the aughts, these skills would translate well to Twitter, which is nothing if not a digital version of note passing. She didn't venture far from home for college, attending Angelo State University, about 15 minutes from Wall. Lawson was able to continue living at her parents' house, but she was still anxious, and she had started trying to manage her emotions in self-destructive ways. "My eating disorder started in college," she remembered. "As my anxiety got stronger, compulsively counting calories and weighing myself was one of the only ways I felt I had control. The anxiety became a little more manageable when, while perusing in a San Angelo bookstore shortly after her 21st birthday, Lawson met the man who had become a comic foil in her writing and a lifelong companion, Victor Lawson. He was nothing like her. He was extroverted, confident, and Republican, but he made her laugh and they fell in love. Her family was wild about Victor, especially her mother, who saw that Victor had a positive effect on Lawson's mental health. About 6 months after Victor and I had been dating, I came home to find that she'd packed up my stuff and told us both that I should just move in with Victor, since I was obviously already sleeping with him," Lawson wrote in her first book, Let's Pretend This Never Happened. The maternal pressure worked. Soon, Lawson and Victor were living together. He proposed not long after that. Lawson wanted to elope. Being the center of attention as a bride was a nerve-wracking proposition, but Victor's family wanted, quote, a real wedding. They compromised with a small ceremony in the chapel of Lawson's grandparents' church on July 4, 1996, when they were 22. They've now been married for almost 25 years. "I've been with Jenny longer than I've been without Jenny at this point in my life," Victor told me. After they married, Victor got an IT job and Lawson worked in HR for a telemarketing company, and eventually they'd bought a house in San Angelo. By 2001, they'd moved to Houston and had decided to start a family. Lawson had seen a therapist during college, but he hadn't given her a clinical diagnosis for her anxiety and angst. That began to change after she started trying to get pregnant. She had 3 miscarriages. Once, after she and Victor had already told their families about the pregnancy and had started picking out names for the baby, they found out there was no longer a heartbeat. Lawson was devastated. "I numbly followed Victor down the halls," she would later write in her first book, "and for the first time in my life, I seriously considered suicide." Meandering through the hospital, she found herself wondering if the building was tall enough so that she would die if she jumped from the roof. Lawson was sent home to naturally miscarry. A month later, still carrying the baby, Lawson had what she described as a nervous breakdown. "My coworkers found me crying hysterically in my office. I didn't even recognize the sounds as human, and I remember wondering what the horrible noise was until I realized it was me," she later wrote. She was diagnosed with PTSD from the event, was put on antidepressants for the first time. Lawson also learned that she had a antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, an autoimmune disorder that can cause blood clots and can result in miscarriage. To manage the disease, she injected herself with blood thinners in the stomach twice a day. The injections made her belly look like a patchwork quilt of bruises. When Lawson learned she was pregnant again, she was so nervous about losing the baby that she developed obsessive superstitions. She was careful not to schedule doctor's appointments on the 13th day of the month. She refused to even say or write the number 13, referring to it as 12-B instead. Once, when she was 7 months along, she got stuck in an elevator. She had to go to the 13th floor, but she couldn't bring herself to press the button. Eventually, she'd be diagnosed with mild obsessive-compulsive disorder and generalized anxiety disorder, but not until after her daughter was born in 2004. "I was having a really hard time enjoying being a mother because I was constantly terrified that something awful would happen," Lawson told me. "I got my anxiety disorder diagnosis when Haley was a few years old. Haley's early childhood coincided with the heyday of blogging. Lawson had always liked to write, keeping a thorough journal of her most disturbing and hilarious encounters working in HR. She loved reading the Houston Chronicle's parenting blog, Mama Drama. One day she saw a farewell post from one of its contributors. It basically said, "I don't think I can be a good mother and also a blogger, so I can't do this anymore," Lawson said. "So I reached out to the editor and told him, apparently I'm a terrible mother because I'll do it and I'll do it for free." Lawson wrote about her experiences with then-toddler Haley with the same humor she had deployed in folded-up notes to her high school classmates. She told Chronicle readers about the time she accidentally let Haley use a glue stick as chapstick and the time her daughter got a progress report from daycare noting her weekly activities, spooning and rubbing. Lawson's posts were tug-in-cheek with titles like "Crack is whack, but cheese is freaking redonkulous," and "Okay, maybe your kids are better than mine." Her irreverent wit, propensity for run-on sentences, and self-deprecation played well in the blogosphere. Eventually, she began making a little money from her writing, and she worked with prominent parenting websites, including Cafe Mom. Soon, she started The Blogess, where she could write about parts of her life that didn't explicitly have to do with parenting. She was more herself on her own platform, able to write things that were too inappropriate for most journalistic outlets. "I think my first post was just the word, the F word," she said. "It was effing shit. We're in business." She enjoyed blogging, but she often felt inauthentic. In 2006, earlier in her tenure with the Chronicle, Lawson had written a post titled simply, "Call Me Crazy," in which she detailed her diagnoses. The post-traumatic stress disorder that had walloped her after her miscarriages, the generalized anxiety, and the mild OCD. "I do worry that people will judge me when they find out that I have an anxiety disorder," she wrote. And after that piece, Lawson tried hard not to overdo it with heavy subject matter. She'd write lighthearted posts in advance to publish during periods when she struggled with anxiety or depression and didn't feel she could perform. "I'd get comments, and people would be like, 'You're so funny.' And inside I'd be thinking, 'I feel nothing,'" Lawson recalls. "The cognitive dissonance really made it worse." So she decided to be more transparent. In January 2008, she published a blog-esque post about panic attacks. "I was starting to think that maybe I didn't need the drugs for my anxiety disorder, but it turns out that when a few weeks of being drug-free, all the panicky OCD crap has returned," Lawson wrote. "Even the math dreams are back. Every time I close my eyes, I'm slaving over impossible algebra problems. Stuff like, what is red plus blue? And I know you're thinking, easy, dumbass, it's purple. But no, it's 8, and you have to show your math." Putting light spins on heavy issues would become a through line in her work. Comments on the post were largely positive, but Lawson still felt sheepish writing about serious subjects. The following year, Lawson published another post titled, "One Day I Will Be Normal," in which she was similarly forthcoming about her depression. She detailed the feeling of being in the hole and described how sometimes when she enters a depressive episode, she loses her peripheral vision. "I live through it, knowing that any day the darkness will dissipate and I'll crawl out of the hole with no memory of what caused the episode," she wrote. Still nervous about alienating her readers, Lawson attached a disclaimer at the top of the post. "This is utterly unlike me," she wrote, "and if it's the first time you've come here, you should skip this whole post and go read this one about how the GPS lady is trying to murder me," she suggested, with a link to the breezier piece. "I just needed to get this off my chest tonight for me and for everyone else who suffers from this. I'll be back to normal tomorrow." The response to the post was not what Lawson expected. What was really shocking is not only that there were so many people who said, "Me too, I also have depression, I also have anxiety," she told me. "But after that, I started getting a lot of people who would reach out and say they were in the process of planning their suicide, and they didn't. Not because of what I wrote, but because they saw people in the comments saying, 'Oh, me too.'" Lawson realized readers could get just as much from the serious posts as from the irreverent ones. Like her, they needed to be able to acknowledge their pain and laugh in spite of it. One day this past February, Lawson encouraged her hundreds of thousands of Twitter followers to introduce themselves to one another in the replies. If you feel alone or want to reach out to others, let's use this thread to find each other, she posted. There were hundreds of responses. Your first book reached me during a very dark time, and I felt like in those moments you really were my friend, wrote one follower. Some shared selfies they'd taken with their pets and talked about everything from their favorite craft projects to their obsession with British TV. Many posted about their struggles with unemployment, loneliness, and fear during the pandemic. Several users connected over having recently lost loved ones to COVID-19. I have many shoulders if you need one to lean on, one wrote to another. One follower wrote about feeling increasingly disconnected from the people in her life. I know this feeling will pass, but I'm having a hard time navigating the quiet place in my head, she wrote. This is a really good way to reconnect, responded another. There's almost nothing more comforting to a person struggling with mental illness than to hear somebody else talk about living with and surviving their own. Despite the fact that nearly one in five American adults lives with mental illness, it is inherently alienating, especially in a pandemic. To read about someone else's pain and see your own experience mirrored in it can provide instant affinity. Any evidence that contradicts the internal narrative that you're all alone, anything that gives you hope that you won't always feel as bad as you do right now, is invaluable. This cathartic give-and-take fuels Lawson's fandom. Her followers call themselves the Blogs Tribe, but Lawson will be the first to say that her massive, super-engaged readership isn't really something she can take credit for. I feel that the community has outgrown me, she's told me. They find one another outside comments now using specific hashtags like Depression Lies and Silver Ribbons, which is a reference to an oft-quoted line in Lawson's second book, Furiously Happy. I hope to one day see a sea of people all wearing silver ribbons as a sign that they understand the secret battle. The Blogs Tribe also makes Pinterest boards and Facebook groups in Lawson's name, in which followers post cat memes and give one another pep talks when someone needs cheering up. PTSD triggered because people can't drive. Give me things that will make me laugh or restore my faith in humanity, read one post. What is it like to start over in a new place? I am scared. I am introverted, and I only have a few close friends, read another, written by a woman who was contemplating a big move after a divorce from her husband of 32 years. One member shared a meme that featured the words, "Your value doesn't decrease based on someone's inability to see your worth," atop a black and white photo of Tranquility icon Keanu Reeves. Lawson has turned to these communities herself in her darkest hours, sometimes her literal darkest hours, in the middle of the night, when she's suffering from insomnia and her brain is telling her that there is something deeply wrong with her and she'll never fix it and it's only going to bring everybody around her down. It doesn't matter how many emotional dips Lawson experiences. With depression, she said, every time I think, I know depression, I've lived with it forever, I recognize it when it comes. But still, she'll find herself struggling 4 days into a depressive episode, wondering what is wrong with her and why she is so worthless. In 2018, the persistence of these episodes inspired Lawson to try repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, a treatment that uses electromagnetic pulses to stimulate the parts of the brain that slowed down during a depression. Lawson chronicled the experience with her trademark repartee in her latest book, Broken. Quote, "It feels like a woodpecker is drilling into your skull for 40 minutes a day for 6 to 8 weeks, she wrote, but the woodpecker did its job. Afterward, Lawson felt better than she had in a while. She even went to Europe with Victor and Haley. TMS, the treatment, provided Lawson a much-needed reprieve from her depression and anxiety, or, as she wrote, a borrowed half a year where I came back to life. But the lows eventually returned. Her autoimmune disorders put her at particular risk during the pandemic, so she hasn't been able to get additional TMS treatments. She's had to find other ways to cope. Those are the times she feels luckiest to have the social scaffolding she's built around herself, especially when she thinks about her anxious relative, who did not have access to similar tools. Every time I start to feel myself falling and getting really reclusive, like even before COVID-19, not wanting to leave my house for weeks at a time, I remind myself of her, and I remind myself that I don't want to be trapped in a bathroom for my life, she said. So I reach out, and there's something about the relative safety of the internet that makes it so much easier in some ways. What with all the trolls and the unrealistic body standards and our tendency to share only the most edited versions of ourselves on social media, the internet and the anonymity it provides can seem inherently terrible for our mental health. But for someone who experiences depression and anxiety and who might already feel quite alienated, the internet can also be life-saving. I feel really lucky that I have this amazing community of people, because I don't have a whole lot of in-person friends, Lawson said. I typically talk to a friend of mine on the phone maybe once every 3 or 4 weeks. I like to text. If I hadn't found an online community and the ability to write to get out the things that trouble me, I suspect I would be extremely reclusive. I think possibly I might not be alive. She hopes that Nowhere Bookshop will become an in-person hub for others seeking community in the post-pandemic world. She and Victor installed a bar in the back where they plan to sell coffee, booze, and food, providing a space where customers feel welcome to hang out even if they aren't buying books. She looks forward to that time, though the idea of a big, flashy celebration for the store's official opening makes her nervous. Maybe instead of a grand opening, we'll have a series of bland openings. Once a month, Lawson told me over Zoom while I sat at the bar. I don't like the idea of a grand opening. I wouldn't want to go to it. It sounds like there would be a lot of people. Next up, we're going to dip back into one of our past issues that we hadn't quite got finished with yet. This will be the November issue. Yeah, November of 20. This is part of the state section. It's Being Texan. It's Traditions. It's by Oscar Casares. It's entitled Beyond the Grave. But first, before we get all the way into this column, I'm going to remind you real quick that you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight in a Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight in a Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight in the Sound Broadcasting since 1967, and now we're going to get to that article. This is Traditions, entitled Beyond the Grave. Every year, my family honors the memory of our loved ones with our Dia de los Muertos altar. This year's ofrenda will memorialize those who have died from the coronavirus. Other than a few framed photos of family and friends who had passed away over the years, there wasn't much in the way of decorations when my family set up our first Dia de los Muertos altar. Later came the banner of Papel Picado, and the year after that, tiny sugar skulls. But no matter how our family altar has changed, it always begins with the same centerpiece, a grapefruit, that takes us back to a faraway memory of how it all began. It's 1938, and my father is a young man. He lives in Donna, just a few miles north of the Rio Grande, where he works at a packing shed. One afternoon, he's loading crates of grapefruit onto the back of a truck when he spots a group of high school girls walking by. He tries to make eye contact with one of them and has no luck. Then he sees a little boy playing near the packing shed and has an idea. He tosses the boy a grapefruit and tells him to run over and give it to the girl in the gray gingham skirt. Tell her there's someone who wants to meet her, he says. Andale. The little boy delivers the gift, and that is how my parents became my parents, and why every year a ruby-red grapefruit sits on the altar. We didn't celebrate Dia de los Muertos as a family when I was growing up. All I knew when I set up my first altar 7 years ago was that it honored the memories of the dead. But I didn't know that the holiday dates back to Aztec times, or that what I sometimes call an altar is actually known as an ofrenda, and that offering food and drinks, along with photos and mementos, is part of a ritual meant to welcome back the souls of the departed every year in early November. The truth is, I didn't start celebrating it for cultural reasons. I began the tradition so my two kids would remember the people they had little to no memory of. My son, Adrian, was born 3 months before my father died, and my daughter, Elena, was entering kindergarten when my mother passed away. I wanted to know who my parents were and where they were born. Most importantly, I wanted them to understand what mattered to my parents, whom they loved, and how they died. Then, earlier this year, the pandemic hit South Texas, and some of the people my parents loved were not spared. This year's ofrenda, we realized, would include not only our distant past, but also the very sorrow that we're living through now. A little sidebar here, heart of marigold. These flowers often adorn ofrendas, as their petals are believed to lead the souls of the dead back to the altars. Back to the text. I was born a couple months after my parents celebrated their 25th wedding anniversary. By that point, they weren't going out so often, but when they did, it was either to a dance or a funeral. In Brownsville in the 70s, Saturday night meant dances at the Civic Center or the Friendship Garden. If they went to a funeral or rosary during the week, it was at Trevino, Garza, Delta, or Darling Mauser Funeral Home. Not that they had that many relatives and good friends who were dying off. It might be a lady from the church they knew only from saying hello to her after Mass every Sunday. It might be the husband of the woman my mom bought her tamales from at Christmas, or the sister of a man my parents used to have coffee with at the Whataburger on Boca Chica Boulevard, or the man at the end of our street who had repaired my father's lawnmower a few summers back. After a while, I gave up asking them why they had to go to another rosary, why they couldn't just skip this one. I'd always get the same answer, para cumplir, which essentially meant to do our part, that or para acompañar, to be with the family. It didn't matter if the grieving wife or husband or in-law even knew who my parents were or how they knew the deceased. They weren't going there to be seen or recognized. They showed up because that's just what they did. If it was a family friend who died, I'd have to tag along with my parents at least to the rosary. But if it was one of their friends I'd never met and shaken hands with, something my father put a lot of stock in, then it was okay for me to stay home. Once, though, when I was 10, my dad took me to the rosary of the father of a friend of mine from the boys' club. The man had been killed in a bus wreck coming back from Ciudad Victoria, something that I still remember any time I'm traveling in Mexico and pass another roadside shrine. Family was different. Losing someone close to us also meant being with those we hadn't seen and held in years. While these funerals were sad occasions, a part of me looked forward to having my uncles and aunts and cousins pour in from Chicago and Fresno and Grand Rapids. Then, after the burial, we'd gather in someone's kitchen or backyard to hear the stories we hadn't heard since the last time we were together. My tío, Nico, would tell me about the afternoon he was in his backyard in Houston working under his car, a buttercup yellow 69 Chevrolet Bel Air, trying to loosen a bolt. Then, just as he turned onto his side, the car suddenly wobbled off its blocks and fell on him. It sounds awful, but not when he reenacted the whole scene, including the way he yelled for help. Bilia, ayudame, ayudame! And then told us how he was saved, miraculously, no other way to put it, when my tía, Belia, and my cousins Hilda and Rosie grabbed hold of the bumper and raised the car just enough for him to scoot out. Then there was the one about the blowout my tío Hector had in the middle of the King Ranch, a good 20 miles from the nearest service station, only to discover his spare tire was flat. He and my tía Nena and my tía Lilia hitched a ride with an 18-wheeler, but there was room only for him in the passenger seat, so my tías had to climb behind the seats and lie down in the sleeper cab, staring up at themselves in the trucker's mirrored ceiling. Or the story about my father driving a taxi one night in downtown Brownsville around Market Square circa 1944 when a guy backed out of one of the cantinas swinging a bar stool at two other men. When my dad got closer, he realized the guy with the bar stool was my mother's younger brother, Oscar, my tocayo, so he slowed down enough to reach over and push open the passenger door so his cuñado could hop in. That kind of story. After seeing my parents attend so many rosaries and funerals, I guess it shouldn't have surprised me years later when my father, already in his 80s and a full decade after retiring, took a part-time job at a funeral home. He'd spent much of his life laboring under the South Texas sun as a farm worker, a delivery man, a fireman, and then a cop and a tick inspector for the USDA, which he did for 33 years, much of that time riding horseback across long stretches of the Rio Grande to make sure livestock weren't crossing over from Mexico and spreading cattle fever in this country. This explains why his belt buckle of a quarter horse also has a spot on our ofrenda. As an attendant at the Trevino funeral home, he was expected to answer the phone, greet and direct people to one of the two chapels, encourage them to sign the guest book, and give directions to guests coming in from out of town. If someone called in sick, he might need to assist one of the funeral directors at the church in burial. He loved getting dressed up for work in one of his dark suits and slipping on a tie from the half dozen he kept hanging on a belt rack. He loved wearing real lace-up shoes, not the ones with the Velcro straps my mother had bought him when he retired and stopped wearing his work boots. He loved being the first one to work and the last one to leave, and he especially loved helping people whose families he had known for ages. My father died in 2007, but I wondered how he would have reacted to seeing all the parents and grandparents, tías and tíos, and primas and primos, who had fallen to COVID-19 in the Rio Grande Valley, especially in Hidalgo County, which is more than 90% Latino and became the epicenter of the crisis in Texas this summer. The county represents only 3% of Texas's population, but accounted for 21% of its coronavirus deaths then. It was here in late July that we lost my father's favorite nephew, my cousin, A.C. Beto Jaime. A couple days later, his wife of 63 years, Dora, also passed away from the coronavirus. After a lifetime of civic involvement, including his time as the first Mexican-American mayor of Farr from 1972 to 1978, Beto was well known in the area. But due to social distancing mandates, his and Dora's combined funeral service was limited to immediate family, all of them wearing masks and discouraged from hugging and crying on each other's shoulders. I can't imagine how my father would have made sense of the restrictions that prevented family members from being with Beto inside the ICU, holding his hand as he took his last breath. What would my father say if I told him that we could only watch from the live stream of the funeral on my laptop, the same one I'm using to type these words now? If he had watched a pair of attendants wheel the two caskets up the aisle and place them near the altar side by side, would he have felt a terrible sob catching his throat, as it did in mine? Of the many ways this pandemic has felt so unfair, it sometimes feels as if the cruelest part has been how it has deprived us of this ritual of grieving our losses together. Growing up along the border, we were all reminded of how precarious life could be, but also of how we would always be there for one another. We understood that, no matter what, those of us left behind wouldn't carry this loss by ourselves. Accepting these recent deaths in isolation has been even more difficult since we're a family of touchy-feely people. We hug, we kiss, we cry, we hug some more. No one cries as long and as passionately as my tía Minerva, who 6 years ago at my mother's burial had to be held back from clinging to the casket as it was lowered into the ground. I still remember the abrazo Beto gave me at my father's rosary, patting me on the back as he squeezed me a little tighter, reminding me over and over that I wasn't going through this alone. Many people's ofrendas this fall will no doubt memorialize family members who have died from the coronavirus. So now, alongside my father's belt buckle and a grapefruit, I'll need to add a photo of Beto and Dora dancing, something they love to do at every wedding and family reunion. I can see that irrepressible smile on Beto's face as he spins Dora one way and then right back into his arms, like the song might never end. Since Beto and Dora's burial itself wasn't live-streamed, I had to hear about it from their eldest son, Bert, who works as a chaplain at a nearby hospital and served as an acolyte during the Mass. Bert had planned to deliver the final prayers at his family's burial, and when the moment came, he walked toward the gravesite, past his five siblings and their families, and the musician they had hired to serenade their parents. They were all waiting for Bert to speak, but as soon as he opened his mouth, he choked up, unable to get the words out. He thought of how his father had died, and then his mother, within 48 hours of each other. He thought of the 2 weeks that had passed before the memorial service could take place. The funeral home schedule had been overwhelmed by the number of COVID-19 deaths in the area. He thought of how accepting his parents' death felt like a test of his faith in God's will, and he wondered if he would even be able to make it through the final prayer. And then he felt someone lay a hand on his left shoulder, and then another hand rest on his right shoulder. He turned to see his youngest brother, Kevin, and his own son, Andres, standing beside him, steadying him. It was all he really needed to make it the rest of the way. Next up, we're going to turn back to our original May issue. This is The State again, and this is The Culture. It's books There's columns by Carlos Kevin Blanton, and it's entitled When the Political Gets Personal. Veteran journalist Bill Minutaglio's latest book is a crowd-pleasing account of heated political battles in Texas over the past 150 years, but does he get the big picture right? Texans take a singular pride in their state's politics. Where else can one find such entertaining grandiosity, unpredictability, and sprawling variety in one place? Pretty much nowhere, as the veteran Austin journalist Bill Minutaglio knows. His 10th and latest book, A Single Star and Bloody Knuckles, History of Politics and Race in Texas on University of Texas Press, came out May 4th. It leans hard, perhaps too hard, into the crowd-pleasing nature of Texas public life. This latest installment in UT Press's Texas Bookshelf series, Stephen Harrigan's 2019 History of Texas, Big Wonderful Thing Was the First, is a readable, even rollicking survey of a century and a half of political conflict. But though the narrative will offer surprises even for those who know the material well, it too often errs on the side of telling a good story over painting a richer portrait of its subject. The title's references to bloody knuckles and race are key to understanding the book. First phrase comes from the Uvalde Congressman John Nance Garner, pugnacious Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and Franklin Roosevelt's first vice president, who advised that in politics, you got to bloody your knuckles. Emphasizing the visceral over the abstract and the personal over the structural makes A Single Star and Bloody Knuckles a page-turner. Minutaglio has no use for an academic historian's need to analyze and classify political movements or issues. For him, the issues matter less than the fight itself. The one exception, and it's a big one, as the title indicates, is race. A Single Star and Bloody Knuckles places this fraught issue at the heart of Texas politics as a through line from the 1870s to the present. Minutaglio directly argues that the state's denial of African Americans' legal existence outside of slavery was one of the founding principles of Texas politics. It's right there in the 1836 Constitution of the Republic of Texas, and even today sets Texas legislators against the federal government over the state's desire to keep minorities segregated and forcibly excluded from the democratic process. The book's 15 chapters are organized chronologically by decade from the 1870s to the 2010s. Among other topics, the early chapters cover Jim Crow, lynching, the oil industry, and prohibition, while the latter ones discuss anti-communism, civil rights, the rise of the GOP, and the decline in Texas of the Democratic Party. Near the end, Minutaglio emphasizes his personal reflections, giving his stories extra pop. In one instance from the late 90s, the author learned that then-Governor George W. Bush's nickname for him was mononucleosis. He thought this was because Bush found his reporting persistent and hard to shake. In fact, Bush simply had trouble pronouncing his name. This story is typical of Minutaglio's tendency to use anecdote, biographical sketches, and a journalist's sharp eye for detail to relay the tenor of a decade. For example, the chapter on the 1870s, when Reconstruction had its brief moment, is told largely through brief portraits of Governor Edmund Davis, a Republican who supported civil rights for black Texans, his successor Richard Koch, a Democrat who adamantly did not, and the African-American activist Norris Wright Cooney. During his administration, Davis planted flowering shrubs at the governor's mansion. Koch, upon moving in, stomped down until each of the damned liberal bushes snapped under his considerable weight. This is an elegant metaphor for the promise of Reconstruction and its tragic, brutal annihilation. The chapter on the 1910s encapsulates the book's successes and shortcomings. The dominant conflict here is the clash between two governors, the impeached James Pa Ferguson and his successor, William Hobby. Chapter ends with Hobby acidly responding to the corrupt Ferguson's mockery of his plain looks by joking that at least he knew the difference between my own money and that which belongs to the state. Stories like this are great fun, but the hyper-focus on the personal means that Minutaglio never fully comes to terms with the progressive movement in which both governors were aligned. The politics of a century ago, as now, were marked by a significant urban and rural divide over class, ideology, culture, and religion, even among progressives. Hobby, who spent most of his adult life in Houston and Beaumont, and Ferguson, who hailed from small-town Bell County, were both associated with progressivism, but they held very different positions on such issues as prohibition, farm tenancy, and school funding. For similar reasons, the book's discussion of populism, New Deal liberalism, and the civil rights movement are less useful than they might be, although in each case they're narratively compelling. Likewise, Minutaglio's preoccupation with the final resting places of Texas politicians is entertaining. Some of these monuments are as droll and pretentious as you might expect, but not especially insightful. Minutaglio assures us he is trying to examine how some Texans are honored and remembered, or forgotten and maybe overlooked, rather than engaging in morbid fascination. Yet the gravestones, statuary, and mausoleums say more about the aesthetic sensibilities of these historic figures and their survivors than about how Texans actually remember them. A Single Star and Bloody Knuckles suffers from another flaw. It offers a flat, monochromatic portrait of Texas's ruling class. Minutaglio implies that the members of the state's political leadership resemble an interlocking elite who has spent virtually every election season trying to out-Texan one another in a dizzying act of performance art. While Minutaglio gets the performative part right, his framing leads him astray. When discussing Lyndon Johnson's entrance into presidential campaigning in the late 50s, for example, he describes Johnson's shift leftward as a move away from his conservative roots and the ciphers, signs, and symbols he had carried from the Texas politicians Ma and Pa Ferguson, Pappy O'Daniel, Alan Shivers, and Coke Stevenson. This characterization is too starkly drawn. Johnson didn't shift left, much as many regional politicians tweak their positions when appealing to a national electorate, but he was always a complex figure. He had a mixed relationship with the sometimes progressive Fergusons, arguably detested the Trump-like O'Daniel, and distrusted the reactionary Shivers and Stevenson. And he came by his populist roots honestly. They were, among other things, inherited from his politically active father and grandfather and inspired by the hardscrabble poverty that he saw up close in the Texas Hill Country. Well before aiming for the White House, LBJ had at least as many liberal moments as conservative ones. Minutaglio's schematic view of Texas politics is reminiscent of, and almost certainly inspired by, the perspective of the late U.S. Senator Ralph Yarbrough and the crowd that gathered around the Texas Observer during the 50s, 60s, and 70s, who believed that a right-wing, reactionary establishment controlled the state. Reminiscent, too, of the Texas historian George Norris Green's 1979 book The Establishment in Texas Politics and the theories of the renowned 20th century sociologist C. Wright Mills, also a Texan. This top-down conspiratorial view of politics overestimates the consensus among the political establishment. Take Minutaglio's portrayal of Beaufort Jester, Texas's 36th governor. People in Austin said that Jester was just another Southern Democrat like Coke Stevenson, Minutaglio writes, in seeming agreement with that judgment. But though Jester was militantly anti-labor, he was not a down-the-line reactionary. In 1948, second year of his term, a group of Southern Democrats known as the Dixiecrats split from the party over President Harry Truman's integrationist policies. Jester, though, declined to join them and in fact supported Truman's re-election bid and backed a statewide anti-lynching law and repeal of the state's poll tax. While Jester was no Bernie Sanders, his record defies Minutaglio's breezy offhand dismissal. The bickering of Texas's ruling class involved more than just personal pissing contests. This idea of a tight-knit ruling group bound by the political principles that emerged from the violent, racist reaction to Reconstruction gets messier still as the book closes in on the present. Later chapters portray the rising Republican Party as heir to those principles and the increasingly multi-ethnic Democratic Party as offering a long-awaited break from them. Yet was Democratic Governor Ann Richards, who served in the 90s, really the last big-time standard-bearer of the liberal, Sissy Farenthold, Ralph Yarbrough wing of things in Texas, as Minutaglio writes? Minutaglio seems to think so, but it doesn't offer much evidence, perhaps because there isn't much. Despite all the fawning praise journalists have heaped on Richards, she governed like other centrist Democrats of that era and had more in common with a moderate predecessor such as Governor Mark Wright than a fiery liberal like Yarbrough. Still, despite its interpretive problems, A Single Star and Bloody Knuckles does the vital work of presenting to a general audience a powerful argument for the centrality of race in the past, present, and future of Texas politics. This is a necessary perspective given the current disputes over immigration, voting rights, and policing. Minutaglio ends the book with a recent Willie Nelson lyric, Delete and fast forward, my son. The elections are over and nobody won. You think it's all ending, but it's just setting in. Perhaps this is a caution to the current crop of activists challenging systemic racism. I prefer to read it as a reminder that making enduring change is difficult. To pull it off, you need to bloody your knuckles. The author of this, Carlos Kevin Blanton, is a professor of history at Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas. Got a few minutes left, so let's go see what's to eat. You can switch over to the dining guide, and this is still takeout edition, even though we've recently lost our mask mandates and stuff. For those who are fully vaccinated, you don't have to wear them anymore, but these are still good takeout places. And up front in the new and noteworthy section here in Houston, we got a new eclectic Mexican place called Trey in Houston, T-R-E-S. Slogan here is tacos, tequila, y todo. We'll take all three at this new Mexican Middle Eastern joint from the folks at La Fisheria. It may even become our new taco go-to. Inside a brightly painted building at the lower end of Westheimer, kitchen cooks up fusion fare like Mexican hummus, lamb kebabs, and chicken shawarma tacos, as well as more traditional offerings and excellent cocktails. Order this to go. Was nary a loser in our choices, selected from a menu of elaborately constructed tacos and machetes, long corn tortilla quesadillas. Fillings range from smoky birria or pulled beef and Baja-style fried fish with chipotle mayo to tart and nuanced chicken shawarma and shrimp diabla laden with fried leeks. And let's see, where's some other ones here? Okay, we got some more here in Houston. Another new place is, we got King Ranch Texas Kitchen. It's American food. Cowboy hats and boots, city slickers are stampeding to this all-Texan ranch house. Big old menu features steaks, barbecue, Tex-Mex, and Gulf Coast seafood. Think of it as Saltgrass Steakhouse's fun, rich cousin. Order this to go. Creamy queso blanco spiked with smoked brisket is a crowd pleaser, but it may need a zap in the microwave when you get home. Other pluses, center cut filet, perfectly cooked medium rare, tasty grilled mushrooms and chimichurri, and a rich side of cheesy grits. Our fave, though, was King Ranch enchiladas, stack of pure comfort with layers of tortillas, smoked chicken, and mushroom cream sauce. A pro tip, or online orders are easy and pickup times can be set. Curbside is available. It's at 1605 Post Oak Boulevard, 832-427-3049. On the net, KingRanchTexasKitchen.com. We've got some updates of a few places here. Bistro Manil is a new American place. Lovely dining spot across the street from the Manil Collection. Offers artful and satisfying dishes, many with Italian or French roots. Modestly priced entrees include two sides with a nice selection of wines to complement your order. Order this to go. The impossibly rich and delicious goat cheese and leek fondue, a round of fresh chavrey atop a pool of melted Gruyere topped with crisp shallots, all to scoop up with thin focaccia, a perfectly roasted filet of salmon with horseradish dill sauce, and juicy seared lemon thyme chicken served with a crock of pan drippings. For a couple extra bucks, add the thick fries with spicy ketchup or a heap of seared Brussels sprouts jazzed up with pancetta. Pro tip, park in the large Manil lot off of Alabama. Call a restaurant to have your order delivered to your car. 1513 West Alabama, 713-904-3537, bistromanil.com on the net. Another update here is Le Baguette. It's a Vietnamese place. We missed the gorgeous plating we experienced pre-pandemic at this favorite Vietnamese cafe, but our order of fresh, wonderfully complex dishes was neatly packed and traveled well. Place is a bargain. Order this to go. Baguettes are right out of the oven, crunchy and soft, and they come layered with pate, aioli, cukes, daikon, carrots, red jalapenos, and cilantro, a surprising and satisfying meld of flavors. Equally fine, tart lemongrass pork, rich oyster butter chicken, subtly flavored brisket pho, simmered for 24 hours, and vermicelli coconut basil prawns, huge and juicy. Pro tip, online menu is comprehensive and the parking ample. 1717 West 34th, 832-548-1080. LesBaguette.com on the net. Another one here, quick update here. Loch Bar, it's a seafood place. Known for an extensive whiskey collection, imported oysters served every which way, is Ritzy River Oaks District Tavern from Baltimore. Dishes out elegant seafood and elevated comfort fare. We pined for the sidewalk patio and great social hour deals, but our go-to meal turned out well. Order this to go. We devoured the charcuterie and cheese from Houston Dairy Maids, thoughtfully arranged with fresh and dried fruit, mustards, cornichons, and caper berries. Grilled Ora King salmon involves an ambitious melange of tiny roasted potatoes and cherry tomatoes, grilled fennel wedges, olives, and seriously spicy red pepper romesque sauce. Also aggressively seasoned and quite hearty is the chicken and sausage gumbo with rice. The icing on the cake, silky cheesecake with both strawberry sauce and whipped cream neatly packaged on the side. Pro tip, oysters are not offered to go. Likewise, save the carpaccio ceviche with homemade potato chips for in-restaurant dining. They're at 4444 Westheimer, 832-430-6601, lochbar.com, LOCHBAR.com. And we're getting pretty close to the end of our reading for today. We're about to run out of time, my friends, so I want to remind you and let you know you've been listening. Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturday afternoons at 5 and Monday afternoons at 2 on Sight into Sound Broadcasting, your...
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30. Now airing on the Noon Book Hour, Recording Library of West Texas Radio proudly presents the novel which was the basis for the classic film starring James Dean, Elizabeth Taylor, and Rock Hudson. Giant, a novel. Giant is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Edna Ferber's sweeping generational tale of power, love, cattle barons, and oil tycoons set in Texas during the first half of the 20th century. When larger-than-life cattle rancher Jordan Bick Benedict arrives at the family home of sharp-witted but genteel Virginia socialite Leslie Linton to purchase a racehorse, the two are instantly drawn to each other. But for Leslie, falling in love with a Texan was a lot simpler than falling in love with Texas. Upon their arrival at Bick's ranch, Leslie is confronted not only with the oppressive heat and vastness of Texas, but also by the disturbing inequity between runaway riches and the poverty and racism suffered by the Mexican workers on the ranch. Leslie and Bick's loving union endures against all odds, but a reckoning is coming, and a price will have to be paid. Giant, a novel by Edna Ferber. Weekdays at noon and 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
I just can't help believing when she smiles up soft and gentle with a trace of misty morning and a promise of tomorrow in her eyes. And I just can't help believing when she's lying close beside me and my heart beats with the rhythm of her sigh. This time the girl is gonna stay. This time the girl is gonna stay for more than just a day. I just can't help believing when she slips her hand in my hand and it feels so small and helpless that my fingers fold around it like a glove. And I just can't help believing when she's whispering her magic and her tears are shining, honey, sweet with love. This time the girl is gonna stay. This time the girl is gonna stay for more than just a day.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 83 and cloudy. Tonight, it will be cloudy with a low in the upper 60s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 70s. Tomorrow night, a few showers with a low in the upper 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McGlamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight and the Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the May issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with the article, I Do Love Me Some Buc-ee's. How the convenience store, with its bathrooms, barbecue, and boundless choices, became the nexus of Texas, by Michael J. Mooney. Felicia lives in Poolville and drove nearly an hour to get here. She brought her mother, Brenda, who lives in Jacksboro, and they decided to make a day of it. They're both wearing tennis shoes, sweaters, and glasses, and Felicia is carrying a blue, bell-shaped, blown glass wind chime on a rope. Price tag, $24.99. You never know what you'll find here, Felicia tells me. Here is a Buc-ee's on the west side of Interstate 35 and Denton, a crossroads in the middle of North Texas. It's late morning on a random Thursday, and Felicia and Brenda are wandering around, chatting as they examine the broad array of offerings, home decor, glassware, books, novelty shirts, knickknacks of all shapes and sizes. Felicia and Brenda come here a few times a year for anniversary gifts, birthday gifts, gifts for as yet unknown occasions. But this wind chime isn't a gift. It's for Felicia's backyard. The mother-daughter duo also come here to spend time together. They normally buy something, or a few somethings, then eat. They usually get Buc-ee's barbecue sandwiches. Brenda prefers the pulled pork, Felicia the chopped brisket. Then, after the sights, the smells, the spending, the full stomach, they head home. If you've never fallen under the trance of a Buc-ee's in person, the concept might sound strange. It's ostensibly a gas station, known for its dozens of gas pumps, you almost never have to wait, and its reliably clean bathrooms. Again, you almost never have to wait. It's a convenience store, but 15 or 20 times the size of a regular convenience store. There are dozens of different beers, dozens of different chips, about 20 different energy drinks, exactly 22 different kinds of fudge, and a 24-hour short-order kitchen. Picture a high-end flea market crossed with the nicest FINA station you've been to, then add a touch of truck stop diner, and then give the whole place a slight theme park vibe. Buc-ee the Beaver, the Buc-ee's mascot, is everywhere. Cups, bags, shirts, hats, toys, and staring down from the wall over the fountain drinks. There are about 40 Buc-ee's locations, mostly in Texas, where the chain started in the early 80s. From the beginning, the mission has been to provide an everything is bigger in Texas alternative to the traditional gritty road trip convenience stores. Every Buc-ee's is next to a highway and in between the big cities, and each location has become a roadside beacon, summoning hundreds of thousands of people every day at all hours of the day. The founder of Buc-ee's, Arch Beaver Applin III, says his goal was to create a happy Texas version of Grand Central Station, grinning people, bustling in every direction. At a travel hub, there can be a certain level of stress, the native Texan and Aggie tells me. What I always look for is the faces, the mood, and that's what I use as much as anything to judge how we're doing. For some, it's a stop to fill up the gas tank and maybe take a quick bathroom break. For others, it's a destination, a wonderland worth planning a day around. It's the kind of place Texans tell out-of-staters they have to visit while they're here. To understand the splendor of this bazaar, I wanted to study what makes Buc-ee's so alluring for all walks of people, yet distinctly Texan. So I decided to spend a day at one location, documenting 24 hours in the life of a Buc-ee's. I'd observe the many, many different items for sale. I'd talk to some of the people passing through. And I'd try to understand what undergirds this strange modern mega-version of the old country store. By early afternoon, Buc-ee's is lively. It feels like a stadium or an airport terminal. There's something happening in every direction. Men chopping meat behind a counter, constructing dozens of barbecue sandwiches at a time. Women slicing and packaging varieties of fudge and candied nuts. Travelers pouring through the doors in search of the perfect snack and drink, and maybe a quick dart through all the other stuff for sale here. Some are in the middle of long road trips. Some are running errands and decided to drop in. Johnny Cash sings from the store speakers, a cover of U2's One. By the front entrance, a tall, pear-shaped old man in wide denim overalls pays the cashier for at least half a dozen Bud Light geladas and a case of Keystone Light. A young couple in workout attire buys a fire pit and a log rack, totaling something around $500. After checking out, they carefully load their new purchases into the back of their white Ford F-150. Then they pull onto the highway and disappear. A college student named Alexis, wearing a leather jacket and yoga pants, talks into her phone so she stares at an entire wall of beef jerky options. "Let me call you back," she says, before moving in for a closer look at a few labels. She decides on one bag of Bohemian garlic and one bag of steakhouse beef. Then she goes back to her phone and back to her life. Throughout the day, I talk with all sorts of people. It's a mix of ages, races, and everything else. It's blue-collar, white-collar, Democrat, Republican, rich, poor. There are people from out of state, people from other countries, and people from the apartments down the road. A mom in an embroidered Texas sweatshirt is driving her adolescent son back home from a doctor's appointment in Dallas. They both sip from their fountain drinks as they contemplate their snack choices. "He has to stop," the mom says. A man wearing creased Wranglers, a rodeo t-shirt, and a cowboy's blue baseball cap with a large 214 across the front stands by the wall of fountain drinks, carrying a tall styrofoam cup filled with cold Dr. Pepper. He says he's on his way home from a casino in Oklahoma, and he seems to be in good spirits. "I did all right," he tells me with a subtle nod. "I came back with more than I left with, and that doesn't happen too often." As a small celebration, he came to Buc-ee's. A just-off-the-clock construction worker waits for a fresh barbecue sandwich. A man visiting from Greece stops just long enough to say he doesn't have time to chat. A University of North Texas football player, offensive lineman Jacob Farrell, comes in for a large order of chicken tenders. Two women who work together came here to get snacks for their